Don't say.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
China's economics are fudged. Microsoft unveils a new tablet, and 15 major banks are downgraded. We have listener questions, and man, do I have a lot to go over with you today. All this and much more on episode number 269 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, it's June 25th or thereabouts, the final week of June, and we're coming into July, and it's been a pretty rocky road when you look at the markets over the last few months. Obviously, a lot of the issues related to Europe is starting to spill over into the U.S. And of course, we have to discuss China today and a lot more. And there's a lot to really kind of keep our eye on. We have a big week of economics, and we're going to go over all of that. And I want you to pay particular attention to some of the things we're going to talk about. And it's going to really have a lot to do with what goes on in your portfolio. I thought we'd start off with this interesting article that appeared on the New York Times over the weekend that was claiming, or at least stating, that there is the possibility that China has been fudging some of their economic numbers. Now, one of the things that economists have looked at over the past when it comes to China is the amount of electricity that has been consumed. The consumption of electricity, particularly in the industrial regions of China. And one of the things that they look at is, you know, how has that changed? What is the use year over year? What is the use month over month? And it has been seen as a pretty reliable indicator in the past, because what you have is the ability to really understand the local industrial manufacturing production capacity, and doing that through the amount of electricity that is being used, obviously, is a really good way of looking at things. And you really have a clear view of that, because there is such a wide region in China. Obviously, the country is massive. And to try to gather all the information and have all of the export and import, everything really clearly identified and revised correctly and calculated right is difficult. But looking at electricity is one way that you can really get some insight. Now, what has been said to be a questionable economic report on the official basis now comes down to, wait a minute, are the localities, are the municipalities and the regions, are they fudging the data when it comes to the electrical usage? Because when you look at how the various regions and provinces in China and their particular parties that are in charge, the officials in those areas, are compensated, if you will, or maybe even stay in power, well, they base a lot of it on the productivity. So the author of this article from the New York Times talks about how, well, it's possible that there's two sets of books that are being kept right now, and that what we're finding is that if you have a decline in usage, it's labeled as a zero. In other words, they don't go negative. And if there's an increase, obviously, then it's marked as a positive. And then all this calculation that's going into it is really worthless at this point. There's been a big question about the official data. We've always talked about the productivity and PMI and the differential between the official number that comes out from China and the HSBC, which always seems to lag a bit. The HSBC Flash Index is a private calculation. In other words, a company outside of the powers of China calculates this and produces this, whereas the data from China itself is obviously the quote-unquote official data, and there's a discrepancy there. Now, all of a sudden, we're starting to get word out on the street through the New York Times, something we've talked about for a couple of years now. Frank Curzio and I have talked about a lot, and other guests have talked about a lot, is the question whether or not we can rely on the data. And obviously, you know, you have to draw the line somewhere of what you can trust and what you can't trust, or else there's no reason to even be involved in investing at all. Now, I understand that we do a lot of questioning here. We question the motives of politicians. We question the accuracy of many of the data points. We question the statistics and how the calculations can be, well, made to look better, like the unemployment rate in the U.S. when it comes to the overall rate and actually how it's calculated using the labor participation rate. We do that because that's what we're here to do, right? We're here to do a little bit more than outside the media, outside the regular, those folks who are getting paid by the various financial institutions and companies out there and, you know, looking for ratings. Yeah, we want ratings. We want things to be good. But you know what? We're trying to find some of the truth inside of all this, which is not the easiest thing to do. And now it just got even more complicated because all of a sudden there's going to be there's an alarm that has rung. And we'll see over the next few weeks how, in fact, China, you know, how we deal with this. Now, remember something. It's kind of bring back memories to me of what was done, I guess, about, how long ago was that? Maybe it was 6 months ago or so, maybe 8 months ago, where there has been a total, just absolute dismantling of the overall Chinese stocks. Sinoforest was one of them that was brought to the forefront by Carson Block. And what Carson Block did was he basically said that, you know what, the data that is being provided is totally falsified. The forestry that they're producing and the numbers that they're producing on their reports are just absolutely false. And that stock took a dive. And this happened for a few different stocks. And the question whether or not this is really something that is a much greater propensity to be happening at a much higher level is really the question right now. Now, next week, we're going to have Richard Yamaroni from Bloomberg. He's an economist, and he covers a lot of this. He covers some of these areas in depth, and we're going to have a conversation with him about this and tracking some of the global interests that are happening with regard to manufacturing, production, shipping. We're going to look at the FedEx indicator, all these things with him, and also going to have Kevin Hoffman on as well, talking about some individual stocks and things to really be, I think, to focus on. So that's all next week, by the way, on the show. Okay, so we talked about the China economics. We'll see what happens. I don't know what your thoughts are on it, but it is very concerning to me, and it's one of those things that you have to wonder, how much do we really care about it? Because if it gets really bad, does China just, you know, totally throw in all sorts of stimulus money? We already see that the coal stocks, well, I should say the stockpiles of coal, are at an increasingly high level in China. We're seeing the coal stocks get absolutely obliterated. We're seeing that material stocks have been just taken to the shed and just beaten to death at this point. And that is probably a reflection on the fact that, yes, we are seeing a slowdown there. I mean, there's no mystery to this. It is what it is. But at the same time, you have to have confidence. Now, I keep on repeating this point that you have to have confidence in something, believe that something is true, because if you don't, not on your basis or my basis or on just the people we know, we're talking about a global confidence that is very important, because that's one of the big problems right now and why the excessive amount of money that have been pushed into the U.S. economy have not been flowing to the end user. One of the things that we're writing about for next month's client newsletter, actually the quarterly newsletter, is something called the velocity of money. The velocity of money. The basic principle is that there can be a lot of money in the system, tremendous amounts of stimulus or tax breaks or whatever you want to use as a stimulus, whether it's the low interest rates. But if you don't have the velocity of money, which is basically compounding the flow of money from one hand to the other, not one pocket to the next, but one person to the next at a high level, because there's confidence in the future and there's confidence of what's going to happen and that your current position is in such a way that you are able to actually pass on, we'll say it, money and goods that moves its way through the economy, you can't have growth. And when you don't have lending that's going on because there's creditworthiness that is subjectively looked at poorly by banks, and banks are now saying, why should I loan because my spreads are low when I have borrowings that are really low, but at the same time, I can't lend it out at a rate that I feel is justified by the risk I'm going to take, then what happens is the velocity of money just shuts down. And that's the key to all of this. And when we look at the things like the Fed twist that we saw last week, where they're going to take and extend the short-term securities that are in their portfolio for longer term, I scratch my head and I say, well, how does that help us? Well, it helps the banks a little bit because there's some possibility of some or the increasing of the money flow into the economy in terms of reinvesting, not pulling it out. But it also hurts the banks because it really squashes their margin. When you look at the yield curve and you look at the flattening of the yield curve because the low interest rates on the short-term debt, and now the Fed is basically artificially keeping down the long-term side, what you have is banks that are just not willing to loan. And I don't understand why the Fed believes that this is a practical way of attacking the economy that clearly does not have the velocity of money that it needs to move ahead. GDP at 1.9% is not good. When we see jobless claims, initial claims coming out in the 380s, and the unemployment rate where it is, whether it's the actual number or the real number that we know that it should be, closer to 9.5% right now, the fact of the matter is that forget about the fiscal cliff, forget about the deficit. Look, just push that aside for a second. It is the confidence that is not being generated by any of these maneuvers, by the government's inability to come to any resolution on any political front or any kind of measure. It's the Obamacare decision that's going to be coming next week, it seems, by the Supreme Court. It's all these uncertainties and the lack of any conclusion to any of these that are creating a roadblock, that are just absolutely clogging the pipes when it comes to moving money around the system, and therefore the velocity of money is nil. So that's kind of what is going on right now in our economy. And the question then remains, how do we get that moving? How do we get that moving ahead? Is it going to be the presidential election with either Obama coming back in and actually making some things happen? Is there a change of the regime? Is it the ability for Europe to come together with a Eurobond or some kind of a backstop to the banks by securing the deposits of the banks on a global, on a or European regional basis by doing like an FDIC guarantee? Something has to give here. Because at this point, the velocity money is showing us that we're at a stall speed and going backwards. ECRI is holding to their recession call, and in fact, the growth rate has dipped down again. We're seeing that basically the spending, consumer spending, that we'll see some more about next week when the economics come out, is pretty much at a zero line. Companies like Darden Restaurants and Starbucks and a few others that are in the consumer space have been saying, hey, we're looking for a slowdown coming up. McDonald's same-store sales are down. And, you know, yeah, there's pockets of areas that are really good. But when we look at the domestic economy that really is standing on the domestic consumer, okay, there's a separation there. The domestic economy that's really upheld by the domestic consumer rather than the foreign buyer, if you will. So if we strip out anything that is in Europe or Asia or Latin America, wherever it may be, and just look at the goods that are moving around inside the U.S. by U.S. consumers, that is an area that is really slowing down. That is not going to bring on a better unemployment rate. It's not going to bring on a greater amount of GDP. It's going to be this lingering effect of cutting costs any way possible. It's going to be the opportunity to increase margins by companies, and that's the only way that things are going to go well for the stocks. That's basically it. And what we're seeing is Hewlett-Packard is laying off some more people, more efficiency is happening. Oh, that's all great for the companies. The balance sheets are cleaned up. That's terrific. Interest rates are very low. They could reissue debt. They could do all sorts of things to the capital structure. Again, excellent. But at the same time, there is an end to all of that where things have to start kind of having, I guess the best way to describe it would be homegrown growth. You have to have it from the inside of our economy because we do affect the rest of the world. We are the largest economy in the world. And what happens here is a big effect on the rest of the world. Now, let's move on for a second from the idea of economics and what's happening. And again, pay particular attention. We have GDP coming out next week. We have personal spending. We have the Case-Shiller number coming out for housing on Tuesday, consumer confidence. We'll take a look and see if that has turned at all. We have PCE. We have all sorts of things that are happening next week and some manufacturing numbers. The Philly manufacturing number that came out last week was abysmal, by the way. Just absolutely awful. So we're going to see if there's going to be a revision to that 1.9% that we saw last month for the first quarter GDP, or for the quarterly GDP, excuse me. And this is the final reading we'll see. There is a chance that we will see an uptick in that slightly due to the increase in inventories. But at the same time, you know, what I see is the manufacturing numbers are really poor, and that's a big component as well. So that's going to be probably pulling it down. So I would say that somewhere around the 1.9 is a reasonable number. But again, that is not a number that we want to see for the potential for growth. And if you really want to get down to brass tacks, it is not a number that we need to see to help pay down the large deficit, because we need a major amount of growth here in order to generate the amount of dollars in incomes that will then generate the taxes that will pay down the absolute debt. And we're nowhere near that at this point. Now, moving on to technology, onto a happier subject for a moment, Microsoft announced their new tablet. Did you pay attention to that? It was kind of a cool presentation, especially for Microsoft. As a matter of fact, I was with a friend the other day, and this guy is he's a techie, I would say. And he is an Apple guy, and he's got his iPad, and he's got his iPhone, and he kind of has a variety of different devices that he likes. And he said to me, right when I saw him, said, "Wow, I think I like that new Microsoft tablet. That is so cool, especially the one that is basically a full-fledged computer where you can run your Word and your Excel and have all your documents and all that. Man, I kind of love it. That Windows 8 with the tiles and all. Boy, that's cool." And I said, "Wow, that's the first time I heard in a while the word Microsoft and cool in the same sentence. You don't usually hear that. Microsoft is, you know, considered the old stodgy company that you have to have because all your business applications work on that unless you're in the graphics design or some other art or some other creative function in business. But basically, Microsoft is on almost every desktop around the world. And it's kind of a utility. And to hear somebody say the word cool with it, wow, I thought that was pretty interesting. So I asked him, I said, "So what's so cool about it? What do you think is, what's the deal?" He says, "You know what? I really like the interface. I love the tiles. I love the active tile nature." Okay, all right. "I love that little keyboard thing that happens. I think that's really neat." Okay, great. He says, "It's a little bit bigger, which I like. And in fact, it can kind of take the place of a tablet and a laptop all at the same time." I said, "Okay, that's interesting." He said, "As a matter of fact, it makes the Apple iPad look kind of obsolete. It's kind of, we need a refresher. We need a new interface. We need something. It's been a number of years." I'm thinking, man, it's only been a couple of years. I mean, the speed of technology change is, I guess, happening at record speeds at this point. And okay, I'll go with it. So Microsoft got some mixed reviews. It's going to be Wi-Fi only to start. We really don't know the pricing points. One of the big issues that came to the fore was, you know, Microsoft is now producing their own hardware. They had some in the past, like a mouse, and they had a few other things and keyboards, and they've tried some things in the past that really didn't play out. Everybody's still a little bit kind of wondering what happened with that phone, that Kin phone they came out with for about a month and then just trashed. And there's been mixed reviews. There's definitely been mixed reviews. The hardware providers are kind of scratching their head going, "Wait a minute, I thought we were the hardware providers, you were the software provider, and how is that going to work?" So now the hardware is going to be Microsoft's. Well, that's good. One of the models that Apple has always had is that they have their own hardware and software, so it works together pretty well. Well, there'll be two models versus one. You'll have the tablet only, if you will, and the one that has the enhanced version, which is a full version of Microsoft Windows 8. One is kind of a tablet version, one is a full version. So there'll be two different ones, okay, so the hardware will be slightly different, I guess, and optimized for each. But at the same time, we'll have to see what happens. It's going to be a little ways off till we actually get a peekaboo at this whole thing. We'll see what happens with the App Store for Microsoft. I'm kind of interested. I don't know how you feel about it. But one of the things that we do know is that there's some questions now being raised. A lot of companies that are making these tablets and laptops, et cetera, using solid-state drives right now. And they're using different hardware specifications than they had because everything has to be a lot smaller, more durable, faster. So one of the things we're looking at is, hey, so who gets hurt by this? Well, we saw that Lenovo came out with a pretty dour expectation for their future. This is obviously the breakaway or the spinoff from IBM. It's a Japanese company now, and they've had a really just a horrible outlook, and HP's outlook for hardware was bad. Oracle came out with a good software number last week or the week before and pretty negative on hardware. We saw that Dell, the same thing. So we're thinking, you know what? What could get hit here? What really is a problem? Where's the bright spot? One of the things that we looked at was the hard drive manufacturers, basically two of them out there, Western Digital and Seagate. Now, the thing about Seagate you have to think about is, okay, what's going to happen if everybody goes to solid state And Seagate may have some things to keep up with that. But if computer sales in general are pretty much dropping and hardware sales are dropping pretty rapidly, well, doesn't that mean that you're going to see some hard times for the drive makers? Now, maybe the video card makers like NVIDIA may do well because obviously that is being used for the very high resolution output that's being included in many of these devices. But at the same time, you have to wonder if a lot of cloud-based services are really popping up and you have fast internet and a lot of people are utilizing the cloud versus their local, and if you have the solid state, it just points to a real negative outlook for Seagate. We're short Seagate. As a matter of fact, the Trigger Point Research, we issued an alert, within the last week or two weeks, on Seagate. There was actually a few days after, there was a downgrade of the companies by a major institution. Stock dropped out 6%, came back about 3%. If you look at the chart of Seagate, you'll notice that it's in a very precarious situation right now. It's clearly under a level of support. It has a gigantic opening in its chart, a gap. And if you look at the potential for a drop here, anything can happen, obviously. But if you look at Seagate, good company, but where they are situated in the hardware area and where they are situated on the chart from a technical standpoint, the fundamentals are good but weakening, and the technicals are looking pretty lousy. So we think this is an interesting place to consider shorting Seagate, obviously utilizing some good stops, et cetera. But, you know, if technology is really slowing down in the hardware area, this could be something that maybe you should take a look at. Now, let's talk about some of the things that happened last week. We had 15 major banks downgraded around the world by Moody's. This is something that had been expected for a long time. As a matter of fact, each and every week, I remember seeing something over the last 6 weeks that Moody's is going to be coming up with a downgrade of the banks imminently. This has happened every week. Now, finally, they came out last week. And one of the things that was interesting was that pretty much, whether it was because they took so long to get it done or because expectations were built in, actually, after the report came out, the banks rallied. JP Morgan, Morgan Stanley, Bank of America, they rallied. Because the ratings cut were no worse than expectations, and they were kind of a little bit better in some cases than the worst situation was, you know, built in. So once again, here's the point of all this, that it is not just the raw numbers in anything, whether it's earnings or whether it's economics. It is the comparative between expectations and what is already priced into the markets or a stock and what actually occurs. So when you have a situation where you have a lot of bad economic data and stocks are kind of selling off, and all of a sudden, you know, you get a couple more that all of a sudden, wait a minute, stocks are starting to rally off of this. Maybe it's because there was a much greater level of disappointment that was built into the numbers already. And the same thing is true with earnings. Have you ever watched when earnings come out and somebody misses by 3 cents worse than the expectations, but yet the stock goes up? You say, what the heck is that all about? Well, again, maybe many of the models that portfolio managers had were really looking for the potential for a little bit of downside. And if it was less than they had expected, stocks rally and vice versa. So one of the things that I think is interesting is that now that we have the major downgrades out of the way, the next question is going to be, what else can hurt these banks? Clearly, much of the capital requirements from the Basel Accord is an issue that still is totally built in to the thinking of many people, and the question is going to be whether or not this is going to continue to hurt the earnings of companies. You also have the fact that the yield curve is flattening. So we all know that. Question is going to be, how much of an effect is Spain, Italy, Greece going to have on these banks? They've been unloading their positions in these securities and hedging themselves out for some time now. But, you know, let's take a look at some of the stats in Europe and kind of consider some of this. You know, first of all, the unemployment rates, Italy, 10%, euro area overall, 11%, Ireland, 14%, Portugal, 15%, Greece, 22%, and Spain, 24.5%. Housing prices in Spain are down 22.5% since 2005 on average and still dropping. The banking deposits are plunging in Spain. In other words, people are withdrawing money incredibly The deposit growth has dropped for 12 consecutive months, and bank losses are shrinking, are growing exponentially because they've also stopped lending to small businesses. So it's creating more of a recession situation there and, you know, creating less income for them. Now, the question is that priced into these stocks? Now, a lot of people who are bullish the banking sector, financial sector, the big banks I'm talking about, the Goldmans, the Bank of Americas, the JPs, Morgan Stanley, you know, they'll point to the fact that, hey, you know what? They're trading below tangible book value. All right, that's important. That's kind of interesting. In other words, the stock price is basically, in layman's terms, below the value of the company. You don't really see that often. And one of the reasons is because there's a lot of unknowns in there. Is there more that has to be exposed in terms of their balance sheets? Is there a lot of things that are being kept at valuations that are very lofty compared to what they should be? We don't know this. We know there was an accounting change back a couple of years ago. And what happened when they changed the accounting laws, okay, they were allowed to mark to market or mark to book or mark to what they thought was the right valuation. So that's something. We also know that there is a huge amount of derivatives and CDS exposure for JP Morgan, Goldman Sachs, Merrill Lynch, you know, kind of you can name all of them, AIG. And the question remains, you know, is that going to be something that's going to, you know, cause them any kind of balance sheet impairment if there is a default, which we have yet to see anything of any significance since that mini default or that kind of sort of, I wonder if it was a default in Greece. And now that there is a coalition government formed, which, by the way, the prime minister and the finance minister were supposed to attend a meeting in the EU this week to kind of resolve some of the issues regarding the bailout funds and their austerity measures. And they both have sick notes. Magic. Somehow, neither of them can attend this particular conference that I think was happening on Thursday because of scheduled or unscheduled or something medically. Now, that's pretty amazing. That means that they're not going to be able to meet with these parties at this EU summit for another month, which the problem is that they're essentially going to run out of money before then. And if they don't apply the measures that they were supposed to, according to their agreement when they got the last bailout, what happens then? So Greece is now asking for an extension of 2 years, on their austerity measures that they had wanted to put in. They're also stopping all the firings and, you know, they're stopping all the pension cuts, and they're kind of going a little bit backwards on some of the things that they had promised to do when they first had committed to getting that bailout and implementing the austerity measures. Interesting. So nothing changes. Nothing changes. We're going to continue on drugging along and just, you know, finding out bit by bit what goes on in Europe and hearing the rhetoric from the European leaders about how, well, we're going to have Eurobonds, we're not going to have Eurobonds, and yes, we're going to have a banking cooperation across all countries, and then Merkel coming out and saying, oh, no, we're not going to do that, and Germany's not going to stand for that, and Germany's not going to do any more bailouts, and then we'll see somebody from Italy say, yes, we have a pro-growth, and we're going to loosen up on austerity, and then they'll come out from Germany and Finland and saying, no way, well, that's not going to happen, and it's going to kind of banter back and forth like a ping pong that is pretty much the markets. So better tune that stuff out. Better looking at the charts, looking at the financials, looking at the trend as a better indicator of the overall market opportunity than kind of paying attention to some of this news, because most of it is BS anyway. There you go. I said it. I did say it. We also have the Supreme Court ruling that's coming up this week, maybe next week at the latest. I think it's this week, on Obamacare. And supposedly if the Obamacare initiative maintains in its full force, that'll be really good for many of the hospital stocks. And you've seen some of them really doing well lately. There's been some consolidation in that area, but generally been doing well. And we'll see what happens with the medical stocks, which have been really doing well of late. And that's interesting. Biotech has really been doing great. You can name a few stocks that are just, wow. Next week, we should see Teva moving up, Teva, the Israeli company. They won a court battle against a couple of different companies. One of them is Momenta Pharmaceuticals in their one of their particular drugs that has been copied And the question of whether their patent was any good was resolved and, in fact, in favor of Teva. So Teva overnight over the weekend kind of went up. They are open in Israel on Sundays. And at the same time, I would venture to say that momentum is going to take a reverse momentum. If you've ever looked at a chart, take a look at a chart, MNTA. The chart looks like it has this drop constantly and then a slow glide up. And then a drop and then a slow glide up. But, I mean, big drops. I would not be surprised if Monday, Tuesday, we see something pretty dramatic from this company, because if they cannot utilize this, this is one of the things they're hanging their hats on, and they're going to see a lot of pain, a lot of pain. Let's get to a quick question here. I got so much here to talk to you about. There was a question that came in. I get a lot of questions. You could write me at any time at askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. And this question, I won't name the names, this fine gent, sent me a question I thought was really interesting, because he wanted to know about his 401k and his investment accounts. And basically, here's the issue. The issue was that he has his 401k with his company, and it's managed by Merrill Lynch. And he has money at a financial planner who works with Merrill Lynch. Okay? Now, he's 61 years old, and he believes he's invested rather conservatively in his accounts. Now, his basic premise of the question was that, hey, wait a minute. I have money in my 401k at Merrill Lynch. I have money in my investments accounts at Merrill Lynch, which is Bank of America, etc. Is that a bad idea? I get all this wrapped up inside of this company that has such a bad reputation and going through all sorts of, you know, problems. And he's kind of freaking out, in his words, about the news and the blogs that he reads and some of the stuff he talks that we talk about, etc. What does he do? Well, a couple things. The big question, obviously, is what happens if something happens to Bank of America / Merrill Lynch, and does that, you know, make his money just disappear, etc.? Well, here's the thing. First of all, you have to separate Merrill Lynch and your investments, because you're not investing in Merrill Lynch. Now, this is not whether I like them or not, or whether I think you should use them or not. That's not the point. The point is that they're the custodian of your investments, which are, you know, usually held in what's called street name. So what you have is an account that is invested, and as long as you're not invested in Merrill Lynch, by the way, itself, in the stock itself, or in Bank of America in this case, well, you're not going to have that much problems, because if Bank of America or Merrill Lynch goes out, you still have the underlying investments that you own. The 401k and all, it's separate, segregated accounts. So the issue of whether or not it's good or bad to be with Merrill Lynch, again, aside, I don't really think there's that much to really worry about, because it's also SIPC and there's a variety of investor-backed pension guarantees, et cetera, depending on where you're located. But again, these are essentially mutual funds and investments that are inside of an account that you own. So they're custodying it. It's your money. That is not held as an asset of the brokerage or the bank. So I think that if your fear is that they go under, what happens? I mean, that's viable, and you have to realize that there'll be a mess that you have to deal with. But you still have your investments. Now, if you feel that, hey, wait a minute, I still can't deal with this. This is something that really bothers me, and I just can't deal with what if there is a mess and I have to too much. Well, then just take your money and put it in a different brokerage house. You know, go to somebody stable like a Schwab or, you know, a TD Ameritrade, or, you know, you can go a lot of different places to give yourself diversification there as well. There's a lot of ways in which you can give yourself a little bit of peace of mind. So I think that the answer that the reason why I picked this was because I know a lot of people have the same kind of questions about the safety of their, you know, their money inside of a brokerage account, and realize that it's somewhat unrelated to the actual broker's stability, because you own the investments underneath in your name. Now, the pension plan, the 401k plan, it's the same concept. But obviously, there's another layer, because you have the company pension plan, you have the custodian and the administrator. But again, all the investments are in your name, especially in a 401k. It's not like a commingled account where you may have a defined contribution plan where a lot of people's money is all in one account, and it's administered by you know, a separate trustee that will break that all down, but it's still one big account. This is a 401k with your name on it. It's, again, it's segregated in your name, on the books, et cetera. So anyway, without going into any more discussion, I think you're in good shape there, or relatively. But you may want to, again, diversify. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I really don't. Let's talk about commodities for a second. Have you checked this out? We put up a commodity chart book last week up on the disciplinedinvestor.com that we track regularly. And there has been quite a change in sentiment when it comes to commodities lately. I mean, oil hit 78 on WTI crude last week, popped back up to the 80 range. But, you know, with the dollar increasing the way it is and with the global concern over a slowdown, you know, all those long positions have been unwinding dramatically and quickly when it comes to oil. Now, crude looks like it really, I mean, 24% from the high to the low recently, and gas prices are coming down. Inventories are still very high when it comes to oil. If you look at the inventory data and you look at the total amount, not on a week-by-week basis, but the total amount of inventories that are held right now, it's still pretty high, which really means that unless we see a lot more production and drawdown on inventories on a weekly basis and refining activity going on, we're going to still see a tremendous amount of inventory glut, which means lower prices. Now, we saw what happened with natural gas when this happened. I mean, it just plunged. And then all of a sudden, things turned around because a lot of the producers started saying, wait a minute, we're not going to be producing this much natural gas if we can't get price for it. And as they slowed down the production, it started to turn around a bit, and bam. You saw one day, a couple of weeks ago, that natural gas was up 15% in one day because there was so many people on the short side of it thinking that there would be an everlasting increase in inventories over the next, 600 years. All those shorts got kind of smoked, and they started covering very quickly. One of the things you want to look at is the Commitment of Traders report. You can kind of look that up and search for that Commitment of Traders report, and look how the traders are betting. Look how there is a change on a weekly or monthly basis from one side of the equation to the next. There's a couple different types of traders. There's the retail, if you will. There's the institutional, the speculators. You want to take a look at kind of where the hedge funds are. And that's not the speculators. And that's not the retail, excuse me. But it's the speculators. Okay? And it's not the players that are in business to hedge. It's the speculators that you want to take a look at and see what's happening there. But look at the total amounts. Look at where things are moving. And oftentimes what we have found is that markets will move somewhat in an opposite or contrary direction to where many people are. When everybody gets loaded up on one side, it seems like a appetizing opportunity for some player to come in and just bust that trade pretty good. Gold now, they've been increasing positions on gold, and commodity traders are getting really very bullish on it. And then we see this big drop last week, you know, out of nowhere. Why? Dollar moving up, maybe. Resolution to the Greece thing, okay, possibly. Spanish bailout, yeah, maybe. But, you know, it's kind of like, you know, everybody gets prepared for one thing, and then when it doesn't happen the way that it was supposed to, like what happened with the VIX last week, where it moved up and then dropped off a cliff after the Greek election. Everybody was kind of protecting their portfolios over the weekend, and then Greek election happened. The new democracy got in. The anti-bailout did not. And all is calm. And the VIX is down by about 18 or change right now. So big drop in the VIX last week because, you know, things were being realized that, well, you know, we're not going to have this implosion, at least exactly right now. But at the same time, you want to look at what's happening with commodities, because if you think about it for a second, it really is showing us that the inflationary pressures are not there. Now, that's not good either. Deflation is not good. Stagflation is not good. It is not really healthy to find that, you know, commodities across the board are being just totally, you know, taken down because of the fact that not only is the dollar getting stronger, but put that aside, but the consumption and the use of it is not that great. You know, you look at the different crop reports and the rain and the weather and all, put that aside for a second. We're talking about the fact that across the board, there's a question about the real use of the commodities at this point. So I want you to kind of put that in the back of your mind when you're thinking about what could be potential stimulus by countries like Brazil, China. India has a real bad inflation problem. They're really in bad shape. As a matter of fact, I believe their finance minister stepped down this week. But India is probably one of the worst performing indices over the last number of months, which, you know what, may be interesting to take a look at where that bottom is and to take a look at some of the ETFs that invest there. I mean, have you seen what happened with Greece and Spain in the last couple of weeks? And Greece is up like 25% in the last, I don't know, 4 or 5 days. Spain has been moving up nicely too. Why? Is everything solved? No, but you know what? When you're putting in a couple of $100 billion into this, you know, situation, that doesn't hurt. And a lot of players who kind of been sitting on the short side of it have finally said, you know what? We got our money out of this thing. Let's kind of move aside and, you know, think about covering at this point. All right, I have something else here I want to talk about. Lots of things happening. Let's see. Got a whole bunch of papers here. Talked about the summit. We got Nike earnings coming out next week. That should be interesting. Stock has been acting very poorly of late. Question about whether or not shoe sales are still surging as they were for some time. Estimates have risen to about 14 cents, have about 14 cents to about $1.30 a share for the same period a year ago. And there's question whether or not the sales will be kind of increased by emerging markets and sporting events. And we'll see what happens there. Italy is going to be trying to sell some more bonds. What else do I got here? Let's see. Japan, we'll see about that, what happens there. Okay. Now, we talked about Operation Twist, how that's kind of questionable, and whether or not that's going to do anything. I think markets were pretty much disappointed because they were really hoping for something much bigger. At least that was being priced in, that, hey, look at all this horrible stuff that's going on in Europe, and look at all this negative economic data that's coming out, and boy, the Fed's going to come to the rescue. Well, here's my opinion on this, just for the record. The Fed kind of is out of ammunition. Now, when I say that, there are plenty of things they can do, right? They can't really reduce interest rates, but they can do more quantitative easing. They can change the banking requirements. They could do some more Operation Twist. They can do another QE. But the question remains of how effective are those going to be? Because they've been done already. We talked about the velocity of money a moment ago. All this has been done already. And we know how much we can get out of this. But at this point, I really believe that the Fed is going to hold back any more quantitative easing until such time that things get really bad, not just in the markets, but in the global, on a global spectrum. And they have to come in, because if they come in too early, it's not going to be effective. If they try to front run this, I just don't think that's going to work. I think they're going to try to do some backdoor bailouts of Europe. They're going to try to convince the IMF and behind the doors of the global view of what's going on, you know, send Geithner, the kneecapper, over there again. Isn't it interesting? He went over there, and a couple days later, Spain comes in with a $100 billion bailout deal. Anyway, the kneecapper. Send Geithner in to negotiate, see if Merkel's going to give up on her absolute demand of not having Eurobonds, and do everything they can, because I think they want to hold this back for the last effort, the absolute, hey, this is, you know, what do they call it, the nuclear option. That will be an all-in at that point. The bottom line is that we need to have not monetary policy at this point, but you know it. We need to have fiscal changes. We need some kind of clarification on the Bush tax cuts, what's going to happen there, on Obamacare, on the deficit, on the debt ceiling, taxes, tax code. We need something, and I don't say something because I, you know, trying to be bullish in the markets, because we need clarity as a country, as a businessman, as a person that lives life. We need to have clarity, because without that, the problem is that you can't move forward. We can't have that confidence that we need so desperately. And that's a big thing that's impeding our economy right now. So with that, I think you have to realize that there'll be some opportunities that will, you know, come across. And if you're kind of stuck with, hey, I don't know whether to invest or not, or, you know, should I put my money in cash or have it in bonds? I mean, bonds are pretty pricey right now. You know, I mean, even with Operation Twist, they started to come down again right after the announcement, which I thought was interesting. 30-year is at pretty low levels. Mortgage rates are at a really low levels. The 10-year is stuck at a, you know, historically low point or thereabouts. So how much lower are bonds going to go? If they go a lot lower, I got to tell you something. That's a problem. Now, a lot of money is coming out of Europe and coming out of emerging markets and being pushed into the U.S. because they're perceived as a much better risk. So the bonds are getting a lot of play as a safety trade. Because if you have to put money somewhere in fixed income, if you had to make that decision right now, you had to, you didn't have a choice of cash. You had to put money somewhere in fixed income. Where would you put it? Would you put it anywhere in Europe? Well, if you're maybe very aggressive and you're going to hedge it out, and if you could find some way to do that, well, maybe. But if you're a pension plan and you have a certain requirement for ratings, where are you going to go? You're going to go to the U.S. That's why you're seeing such an incredible demand for our bonds right now and the stocks. Because, again, it's the same point. You know, where are you going to go? Now, I want to mention to you, let's see, two other things here. I mentioned Seagate to you. Let's talk about some stocks for a second. There are some stocks out there that have been really taken to the cleaners. Just trashed. Look at the coal stocks, like a Patriot Coal. Look at Alpha Natural Resources or Peabody. Just look at these, many of the energy names. Look at some of the gold stocks. What's interesting is that some of these are getting to a point of being deliciously undervalued, from a point of that there is institutions that will come in and support some of these. Now, I'm not just saying the coal stocks right now, but I got to tell you, there's a lot of play on the short side there, and there's a lot of selling going on, and that's going to eventually kind of come to an end, and you know we'll see a little bit of a bounce here. Now, that may not be a long-term trade, but or a long-term investment idea, but at least a trade. Westport Innovation, something that we alerted, about beginning of this month. We did 6-7 on the 7th of June. We alerted that for Trigger Point Research subscribers, which, by the way, 14-day free trial. Just go over triggerpointresearch.com/subscribe and click on the 14-day free trial. You get emails and text alerts of things that we are alerting, and we do this in a very disciplined manner, in a way that gives you all the information you need, from a target to a stop loss, charts, etc. You get an email, get it on the website, and you get it on text if you want. But anyway, Westport Innovations up about 10.5%. That stock is in the business of converting engines to natural gas. A couple of different companies that do this, but this is really the well-known one. And boy, that stock was obliterated, and we are up a bit on that. Very, very volatile, but a good stock, I think, in terms of long-term opportunity. Couple of the ones the gold stocks, we moved in and out of. Randgold, we hit a price target. Randgold Resources, back in the end of June, we picked it up on an alert at, let's see here. I'm trying to find out where we have the price alert. Here we go. 79, sold at about 85. It's about $90 right now or so. We also had Nuance, actually, which we lost money on, about 7%. And GNC Holdings. Actually, LNG is interesting. Cheniere Energy. We picked that up and hit our target pretty quickly, actually. Made about 24.67% in a matter of, let's see, what was that? That was 10 days. And this stock is drafting down again. I would say that we would look to pick this up again at about the same price that we picked up last time. It is in a zone that is consolidating right now, and it's not ripe yet. It's just not ripe at the right price. That doesn't mean it can't go up from here. But, you know, we want to see that where we can find a really, really good support point and a bounce off of that, or a breakout or breakdown. That's the whole idea. Crocs is one on my list again. Crazy as that sounds, that kind of comes and goes. It has to come up with a very specific pricing point, and it kind of looks like it may be there. One of the things that I want you to look at very carefully on a contrarian basis right now is watch the short interest on stocks. Where you see short interest about 5 or 6 days to cover, meaning that it will take 5 days to cover all the short interest at the average volume that the stock trades on a daily basis. Look at that as an interesting opportunity for when stocks move, that these will really move pretty hard. As a matter of fact, last week, I think it was Thursday or Friday, I put together a list of stocks that had, from the NASDAQ, that was the index, over $5, traded over 500,000 shares per day, market cap of, I think it was over a billion, or maybe a little bit less than that, and that had short interest ratio of 5 days or greater. I think we got 184 companies. And what I did was I looked at the performance of those over different time periods. And it's amazing that over the last couple of weeks, those stocks are up like 5.5% compared to nothing for the equity markets. I mean, it was just a big differential, big spread. On Friday alone, it was up like 1.9%. When you look at the other side, which is the stocks that are not in that universe, if you will, they significantly underperformed. So what that's telling me is there's a lot of very nervous short sellers out there that are going to cover very quickly at any kind of either good news or market rise. Now, what that should also tell you is on the opposite side of it is that if you are short a position, don't be so nervous to just cover it because it's moving up. Make sure it hits a stop point that you predetermined that's moving past a specific resistance point, and you got to kind of figure where the other shorts were in at that point. You have to kind of look at some volume statistics and all that. But basically, you know, if you're going to short, don't just be spooked out right now because markets are going to be volatile, and there's going to be days that you're going to get hit on your shorts, and there's going to be days that you really make a lot of profit on your shorts. One of the things I did notice, and you could look, is that almost on an every other day basis right now, the shorts that get, you know, hit the most, or the stocks that get hit the most, maybe the ones that have high short interest, will come back the most when the market moves the other direction. It's kind of like if you notice that many of these stocks that dropped due to earnings, a day later, they're back up, just, you know, we're not up to the top, but just they move back up. It's like there's too much panic going on both sides. So keep aware of that when you're looking at your portfolio, that you're going to see excess volatility when the VIX is near 20 and over 20. And particularly for individual stocks, you know, you see a 1% drop or rise in the markets, you're going to see a multiplier effect for an individual stock. You're not going to see just a 1% here or there unless you have some of the, you know, the J&Js or, you know, Merck or something like that. But, you know, when you look at many of the other stocks that are out there, particularly the growth-related stocks, the ones that have growth and are the kind of leaders in the markets over the last year or so, you're going to see excess volatility there. So keep that in mind. A couple of the other stocks that we're looking at is, that's interesting. I still like the mining stocks. We've been in and out of those. And we keep on, you know, having alerts and then at the same time adding them to our portfolios, taking them down, adding to the portfolios. And they've been moving around pretty rapidly with the price of gold. But I still have a really good sense about a few of these and the gold miners in particular. Copper, no. Silver, eh. But the gold miners, I still have a pretty good taste for it right now. Generally, not every single day, not, you know, not every week, but the general concept of them. With the addition of the Microsoft tablet, we have to really put some consideration into some of the players that are in that area, some of the motion sensor players like a Silicon Motion or, you know, some like the NVIDIA that we mentioned before, OVTI for cameras. Yeah, you just got to look at some of these names and see what's going on with them and whether or not they could be, you know, profitable because of this new product launch that's going on. And also, you have to be aware that with this questionable accounting and economic disruption that's going on in China, that you could see some of the stocks in that region start to get a little bit, a little wonky. So keep your eyes on like Ascena, NetEase, Sohu, China Mobile. You know, keep your eyes on those stocks and particularly the companies that are related to China and have exclusive you know, movements related to China, because if there's going to be some questions, there's going to be, you know, with this kind of market condition and investors being so quick on the trigger, so to speak, I think you'll see a lot of, you know, movement that may be a little bit disruptive. Let's see, what else do we got here? I think that's going to cover it. I mentioned that we do have, of course, we're going to talk about the Microsoft tablet on DH Unplugged this week with John Dvorak. If you're not listening to that, I think you're missing something. We have a good time on that show. We talk about all sorts of things that are in the news and off the news, and we get a little crazy. It's an unscripted discussion between the two of us, and it's kind of a very interesting, I think, discussion. And we also have our game that we play, which is picking stocks and trying to figure out where is there going to be a great opportunity. And we track those on a spreadsheet that's live and available for you to take a look at. So you can take a look at that over at dhunplugged.com. And listen, we usually record on Tuesday nights for release on Wednesday. So definitely stay tuned for that. And if you have any questions, of course, you know where to find me. Ask Andrew at thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Basically, what you want to do is just simply write me, and I'll be happy to answer anything I can, put it on the air, on the podcast. And I thank you very much for all the kind words you put on iTunes lately. If you want us to manage money for you, whether it's through the global allocations we have or the Disciplined Investors Managed Growth Strategy, just go over to the Disciplined Investor. There's a little blue icon there that says check out the virtual tour and a hedge fund, that hedge fund like investment without the hedge fund is a, 12-minute virtual tour. Check it out. I think you'll enjoy it. Find out how we do, what we do. And if you do want that 14-day free trial of Trigger Point Research, and if you haven't done it, I don't know what you're waiting for. Seriously. This is you get 14 days to see if you like this thing. No, you don't even have to put your credit card in, nothing. Just sign up and you start getting the alerts when they happen, and you get full access to the site for 14 full days. You get the pro package for 14 days over at triggerpointresearch.com/subscribe. All right, that's going to do it for this week. Should be an interesting week ahead with all the economics that we have going on, and I'm very interested to see what's going to happen with GDP and the fallout, if any, from this whole China situation. I'll see you next week. And again, we have Richard Yamaroni from Bloomberg and Kevin Hoffman. He's going to be here. Lots to talk about, lots to do. Have a very, very profitable week. See you soon. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations, and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor, regulated in various states. None of the information presented that should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.